Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. How would you like to study or do research in Cuba? Well, it's actually possible, and it is possible this coming summer for MTSU students and faculty. The man who is making it possible is Dr. Rick Morris, who is a professor in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures, teaching Spanish and linguistics. And he is offering an opportunity for a one-session course to study at a Cuban university and actually earn credit, or if you are a professor or instructor, to actually conduct research in Cuba. Any and all majors, if you're students, any and all disciplines, if you're a professor. And Dr. Morris is here with me to discuss the possibilities and the trip. And you had a meeting on September 28th in which you had an opportunity or gave an opportunity for people to learn more about it, to kind of see what kind of interest was out there. What was that meeting like? How did it go?
Well, we divided it in two portions because we knew that there would be interest on the part of students and faculty. So first we talked to the students for about 45 minutes and then to the faculty kind of at the end. Because depending on who you are affects how you can get to Cuba. It's a complicated process. It has been for about the last 50 years. The complications are all on the U.S. side. Really, there are no rules in Cuba about who can go to Cuba. They love it when we can visit. But the rules are complicated at our end. The good news is that we're not completely blocked from going. Many people think we simply can't go to Cuba legally. But in fact, educators, students, graduates, undergraduates, both have ways that they can actually travel to Cuba legally. What we wanted to do at that meeting was show the various ways that this is possible, hoping to pull together interest on the part of students and faculty and maybe put together a grand visit where we might all travel down together on the airplane, although our purposes might be very different at the other end, whether we're doing research, studying, or taking classes. But that was the plan, to have that as sort of a starting point for summer of 2011.
We're talking about the University of Havana, and what would the curricula be for the students who would be going?
Well, for the undergraduates, their program is the one that would require sort of the most attention and planning because of the U.S. rules in place right now. What we're planning is a 10-week program, and 10 week is the minimum for undergraduate study in Cuba right now, which is kind of restrictive when you consider that most study abroad programs conducted at MTSU range from between maybe 4 to 5 or 4 to 6 weeks in duration, so it's quite a bit longer. What we're thinking we would have them do would be to take Spanish and also Cuban culture classes, from about May 20th until the end of July. So it would be through the summer session. Approximately 4 hours a day spent taking Spanish at the appropriate level. Students would take a placement test on arrival and then be placed with other students in a class. And these students would be possibly from MTSU or from other universities around the world. This is a program that runs through the summer for teaching Spanish to foreigners.
So regardless of whether you're a beginner, intermediate, or advanced in your knowledge of Spanish, you could take a class finding one that is right for your level.
That's right. You could go having no Spanish experience whatsoever. Of course, a little bit helps, but you could start at Spanish zero if you wanted to. The other class that students would be taking at the undergraduate level would be a Cuban culture class. This particular course we just started putting together yesterday and came up sort of with a title for it, and it looks as if it could be something that is greatly appealing across the disciplines. The tentative title is Anthropological History of the Cuban People, and this would be a 20-hour course that would be taught at an anthropology museum affiliated with the University of Havana by professional faculty. It would be five sessions of 4 hours that would be conducted over the course of this 10-week undergraduate program. Students who took that class would conceivably earn credit in any number of classes taught at MTSU. And so we're kind of wrangling out the details of that as we speak. But my hope is that we would be able to host history, anthropology, possibly global studies students, and get that course cross-listed at the MTSU side.
And for the faculty, what sorts of courses of action are you anticipating? Or can the professor design their own particular research model or research approach?
Well, the rules are a little bit more lenient for faculty. And again, we're talking about the U.S. government rules, specifically those that are put together by the United States Treasury related to the embargo.
Oh, it's the Treasury Department, not the State Department
you're
dealing
yeah,
with?
It is, for all intents and purposes, the Treasury.
Because of the economic embargo.
That's right, yeah, since the early 1960s. And it's the rules have been lightened and tightened at various times since then. Currently, what's permitted is a professional educator at a university, usually meaning at a university, is able to visit Cuba under what's called a general license. And what this means is that they are pre-approved to travel to Cuba if their intention is to conduct research that is not commercial in nature, not related to the production of biochemical weapons, and a couple of other obscure limitations of that nature, specifically if the research has what they call a high likelihood of publication. In other words, research that is intended to become part of the educator's professional record, not research for fun.
Published in academic peer review journals, that kind of thing.
That's that sort of thing, exactly. So technically, any faculty person at MTSU who felt like they wanted to do a research project, specifically related to Cuba also. You wouldn't be able to go to Cuba and study French cooking, for example.
Makes
it would
sense.
Need to be, yeah, or even maybe Caribbean cooking. It would need to be specifically related to Cuba. Would be able to travel to Cuba at any time under what's called the general license. How they would do that, there are some restrictions on how to book the travel from the United States. There are restrictions on how much money they can spend while they're there and sort of what they're supposed to do and not do while they're in Cuba. A lot of information that can be read online at the U.S. Treasury homepage. The Office of Foreign Assets Control has some very detailed instructions for anybody who might be thinking about doing that. But it's surprisingly easy to do. I've not traveled to Cuba as a researcher. I've traveled with student groups and on my own. But I know from several colleagues who've traveled at different universities that it's quite easy to do.
Why and how did your interest in Cuba develop?
It's an interesting story. About 10 years ago, I signed up to take a trip with MTSU's Campus Recreation. They were billing it as an adventure trip to the Big Island of Cuba, and this was in, spring break of the year 2000. And I signed up to go just as a participant. Well, there was some problem with our license at the time. The university had a license to go, and apparently there were some holdups with the license, basically, and they needed somebody to go on the. They needed somebody who was already participating on the trip to go as sort of a faculty person on record. The trip was lacking an academic component, and therefore there was a licensing issue. So another colleague who was planning to go, who also teaches Spanish in the foreign languages department with me, and I were asked to be instructors of record. And the trip was retooled at the last minute as a Spanish conversation course. It was not an ideal situation. But in fact, everybody who went was required to enroll in Spanish 3000, which was a one-hour course, and submit a journal at the end, and that is what kept the trip legal. We did kind of the same thing again the next year, but by that point we thought, let's just put together a full-fledged program so we don't have to be sort of running this in the dark as if we're up to something. So in 2003, I retooled the program again and led it as what we call an in-house program in the foreign languages department. It was an undergraduate program, and the students earned credit for taking the conversation course. I think we had 12 go. More specifically to your question, how did I get interested? Well, by being there, first of all, I've traveled quite a bit. I lived in Europe for 8 years, lived in Argentina, visited East Germany when it was still communist, been to some unusual places, Iceland, Tierra del Fuego, and kind of always been fascinated by the more unusual destinations. And Cuba had definitely had that. So over the years and traveling to Cuba again in 2004 and again in 2006, I've always been sort of fascinated by how Cuba is not what we expect, and yet it is what we expect at the same time. It is definitely a country of contradictions. You don't quite know what you're going to find. You don't quite know how the people will respond to you, and that sort of thing.
How do you find the Cuban people's attitude toward Americans from what you've experienced in your travels?
That's a good question, and that's one that people ask often. There's sort of an assumption that maybe Cubans don't care much for Americans, but in fact, they're very open. They're very friendly toward American visitors. They will tell us, "Oh, we love Americans. It's your government we don't like." You know, which you sort of take that and do it whatever you want with it. But they have always felt very close to Americans. A Cuban once told me that in all of the time that they were sort of buddies with the Soviet Union, the many, many years that they were part of that alignment, they never felt any kind of closeness with the Soviet Union. It was always the American movies and the American television programs that they liked the most.
Do you think that Americans' attitudes in general have changed toward Cuba with the end of the Cold War?
Yeah, it's hard to say how, because I imagine everybody's fascinated with Cuba. When we hear about it in the news, we don't quite know what to make of it, and so we're not quite sure how to proceed. I think that there are many people who would love to see Cuba opened up as a marketplace. Then again, there's many others who would probably just like to see it stay about the same as it is, as sort of a somewhat isolated exercise in social reform. Like it or not, there's some very interesting experiments underway in Cuba, and they've been underway, and there have been a tremendous number of successes. Controversial, absolutely. But it's definitely to fully understand Cuba, you have to go. There are so few books, so few documentaries that really do it justice. I find that most of the books that I've read, published in the United States, for example, take some kind of a stand or a posture towards Cuba that I don't think is really, really sort of up to date with the real Cuba, the Cuba that actually exists.
Kind of jingoistic in nature?
Yeah, exactly. You get both sides of the political spectrum kind of harping on various issues, and it's always fascinated me that generally books about Cuba tend to be at least 500 pages long. That right there tells you that there's an awful lot to say about it, and at the same time there may not be all that much to say about it. When I need to get Cuba news, I turn to foreign news sources. I like the BBC, for example. It tends to be short and sweet. There tends to be not a whole lot of political posturing that takes place with respect to the issues that we hear about.
So you're saying that when we think about Cuba and when we learn about Cuba, there's a more nuanced, complex picture to be seen than perhaps the one we're accustomed to seeing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I need to choose my words carefully because I, you know, just to be respectful of everybody's views who might be listening. But the perspective that we have of Cuba and of the United States, of the complex relationship between these two countries going back many hundreds of years, is not correct based on the news that we run into on a daily basis. It simply is not. And I say that having studied Cuban-American relations both from the American side and the Cuban side, using free internet, using all the resources at my disposal, that we don't have an accurate picture. We can choose to have an accurate picture, however. One way to do that is just by being judicious in what we read, what we listen to, not being too full of our own views or perspectives, and when the time comes to go and visit Cuba and see it for ourselves.
Do you anticipate a day when Americans will be able to more freely come and go between our country and the Cuban island?
It's a good question, and I hope so, and also I kind of hope not, but more than anything, I hope so. There do seem to be some changes underway right now under the Obama administration. It does seem as if there could be some increased openness within the coming months or coming years, hopefully sooner than later, that would allow Americans to visit Cuba, not just educators and journalists, students and so on, but anybody. And in fact, under the Clinton administration, there were what we called people-to-people programs, which were programs of a more general nature where people with humanitarian or socially progressive interests could travel to Cuba legally. It was much easier to travel to Cuba. It was much easier to get a license. That would probably come first in any case. It would be a little bit farther off, I think, to expect to be able just to jump on a plane in Miami and fly down to Havana the way people did in the 1940s.
With regard to the educational program itself and the opportunity to go there, is there anything that would stand in an individual's way, supposing that they had, anything in an individual's past that might stand in the way of their going there? I assume that the government would investigate the individuals who want to go.
You never really know. I mean, I guess there's sort of a standing joke that if anyone who goes to Cuba probably has a file opened about them somewhere.
Trust but verify.
I don't know. I mean, I figure if they've got if there's something in my past that somebody's interested in, they'd probably find ways to find out about it anyway. Things that would stand in people's way, I would say, would probably be just incorrect perceptions. Mm-hmm. Cuba, unfortunately, is also not cheap to visit. It tends to be a little pricey, and that's just because it's not set up for tourist visiting. There tend not to be the little one-star hotels that you can stay at. Most hotels in Cuba are three-star hotels. They very much want to maximize the tourist dollar or the tourist euro, as the case may be. So the price can be a little bit prohibitive.
What is the exchange rate right now? Do you know?
I don't know. I know that there's kind of an ongoing saga of how what currency one uses when in Cuba. And if I understand it, lately it's the euro. For the longest time it was the dollar. And now it's mostly because of the recession, according to my colleague in Cuba, Rodrigo. They've switched over to the euro. They've decided they don't want the dollar.
But they're not a member of the European Union.
That's right. I think it's partly a slap against the United States and also partly a reflection of the reality that the euro is simply stronger right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How much do you know about higher education in Cuba, the quality of higher education in Cuba?
Well, education generally in Cuba is extraordinarily extraordinarily well-developed, considering the lack of basic resources. A typical school, I know you're asking about higher education, but just to give you an idea, a typical school would have actually very few textbooks, although there may be a very, very complete library. So there are some kind of surprising contradictions in education. The literacy rate in Cuba is very high. It's much, much higher than in other Latin American countries. It ranks up with the United States and Canada and Uruguay and Argentina and some of those countries. Colleges and universities in Cuba tend to be more trade-based. So, for example, instead of a student going to college and getting the well-rounded liberal arts education, for example, a student would choose, perhaps at an earlier age, to go into teaching or to go into medicine or to go into engineering or some other field.
So there's a vocational aspect to it that's not like your typical four-year liberal arts education here.
Yeah, and I think that probably has a lot to do with the Cuban mentality of equipping themselves as best they can with minimal resources. In other words, sort of going out and finding yourself in higher education, I don't think is part of the plan if you're a student in Cuba today.
I know that in other study abroad experiences, they have in the past had relationships whereby students could, and sometimes professors could, stay in homes in the host country that would agree to take them in for however many weeks they were there. Is that a possibility with the Cuban trip?
Well, that's a wonderful opportunity. That would not be the way we do it this time around. In this visit that we're planning, it would be guest house lodging. I don't think that would probably be a good one for Rodrigo also.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you established the kind of connections there that would enable, if this was a yearly endeavor or became a yearly endeavor, if you established connections that it could become a possibility for, you know, developing more contacts and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it could
help
be.
To defray some of the costs.
Yeah, exactly. Rodrigo would probably be able to tell more about the logistics of that. As far as I know, he doesn't coordinate any kinds of programs that involve homestays, and I don't know whether that's because of some restriction in Cuba against that. I know that there's sometimes some unexpected rules about hosting people in your house or making money off sort of for private gain and things like that. Those factors like that may actually be standing in the way of that possibility.
Your friend Rodrigo Gonzalez was with you at the September 28th meeting at which you introduced this idea to people in the student body and the faculty who might be interested. Tell me a little bit about your friendship with him and how you got to know him and where he fits into the whole picture.
Well, he's a very interesting person. I love that I can actually say that I go way back with a Cuban, because at this point I do. Rodrigo actually was the guide on the 2003 trip, which was the first one that I led independently. But he was so much more than that. He met us at the airport, of course. He accompanied us everywhere we went and was our guide wherever we went. In other words, he didn't hand us over to a guide as we traveled around the city. He was our guide. He knew all the stats and facts about the various, you know, districts of the city and how old this building was and sort of who lived here and what went on in that building and so on. He had it all in his head, and he traveled with us. He stayed with us. He was just all around good man in Havana. And at the very end of the trip, both times, he got up with us at 4 a.m. to catch our outbound flight. So, of course, it's hard to keep up with anybody in Cuba. just simply because of the nature of the communications between our two countries. Email service tends to be spotty. All internet and email in Cuba is still dial-up, which means that one can't easily trade photos, for example.
Is it inspected? Is there surveillance on it?
I asked him. I had kind of a frank conversation with him while he was here, because I was curious to know. Because I know that, for example, he reads the Miami Herald, and I just asked him, so what is the deal? I mean, can you read what you want? Can you write what you want? If you sent somebody an email message in which you expressed something that might be sensitive, what would happen? And his frank response was, well, in fact, it probably is gathered somewhere as intelligence. They're very concerned in Cuba that people are trying to stir up rebellion. But they're not generally wary of people being interested in American affairs or in reading American newspapers. What they're most concerned about, he said, is people seeking money from the U.S. government to stir up rebellion, or people who might be involved with certain dissident groups. But he said that he didn't actually feel any sense of he wasn't concerned for himself in any way.
Is there anything in particular about the Cuban people or the Cuban culture that you find more fascinating than those of any other Spanish-speaking country?
It is interesting how the sort of the Hispanic, for lack of a better word, Hispanic worldview fits together with the Cuban revolutionary ideal. There are two sometimes contradictory ways of going about life, sometimes with very interesting results. I'm thinking, for example, of the cultural machismo that's so typical in Latin America, which is pretty much 100% at odds with the socialist revolutionary person. And in fact, Cuba has passed all sorts of laws mandating total equality of husbands and wives in things like cleaning house and taking care of children.
How are those enforceable? How do you enforce those?
I don't know. I don't know, but it's fascinating. And in fact, the Cubans themselves are fascinated by this. They're very aware of this contradiction because the Latin machismo is definitely still a part of their society. Actually, some of the best movies that have come out of Cuba have dealt with this contradiction.
Getting back to Americans' perceptions, the lens through which we view Cuba when we view it at all, has the end of the Cold War, for all intents and purposes, caused us to take our eye off the ball when it comes to Cuba? And I'm not just talking about the Castro regime or the government, but the people themselves, because 9/11 has tuned our focus in toward the Middle East rather than Central America or Latin America. Do the neighbors in our own hemisphere, including Cuba, get short shrift from us anymore because of that?
Well, I think so. I think it's definitely not to anybody's advantage that Cuba has sort of retained the status as an enemy country, being classified alongside such countries as North Korea and Syria. Although it may have some things in common with those countries, it actually has most things not in common with them. So it sends kind of a peculiar signal to people who might be, trying to find information about Cuba or visiting Cuba or Cuban-American policy or things like that, when they see that Cuba is pretty much lumped in with some of the more renegade nations. Does that answer your question?
I think so. I'm hearkening back to the time when, Nelson Rockefeller was sent as an emissary in Central America, and he got rocks thrown at him and such, and the era of Yankee go home, and all of those kind of things. Plus the fact that in the public school system in any way, when I was in high school, you hardly touched on South America at all. It just was not even thought of or talked about, or it's just, you know, there are a bunch of Spanish-speaking countries and they're down there. You know, you aside from the fact that Venezuela has oil and Colombia is a center for drugs, they deal in hit-and-miss, scattershot stereotypes if they deal with it at all. You concentrate on Europe and the United States and Asia to an extent, and you just ignore South America and Africa.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I think that all the focus, the greatest focus Cuba ever got was probably during the missile crisis, and that probably is when it peaked.
Do you anticipate that if this is successful, that you can turn it into a yearly experience where it will become a regular part of the offerings that are available here at MTSU?
I hope so. That was my original plan with the program back in 2004. The 2004 program was slightly different from the 2003 program in that it was an actual dedicated class. It was Spanish 3015, which was called Contemporary Cuba, and it's actually still in the MTSU course catalog. The idea was to actually teach that course every year on a program such as the one we did in 2004. As it turns out, it hasn't been taught since. What we're going to be teaching in the summer of 2011, hopefully, will be quite a bit different from that particular course, but I'm definitely hoping for just the word of mouth to get out and have the numbers grow each year as they did in the past.
Is there a ceiling on how many people you can take?
Not that I know of. I think generally study abroad programs, they reach sort of a critical mass around 15 or so. I know that there are some regulations that MTSU about what the ratio needs to be between faculty and students, but I'm not aware of any sort of maximum number. One thing to mention is that there is also a third category that we're hoping to implement in the 2011 trip. In addition to undergraduate and faculty, we're also putting together a graduate component. Now, graduate students actually have it easier than anyone. It's a wonderful time to be a graduate student and interested in Cuba because the accessibility is probably easier than just about anybody else. Graduate students are able to travel to Cuba to do research projects like faculty, and they don't have the 10-week minimum restriction that undergraduates have sort of across the board.
You're referring back to the Treasury Department's rights.
That's right. Yeah, all the rules are pretty much rules on the United States side. The Cubans would love to have us at any time. Anybody, come one, come all. So that third portion would be open to any graduate student in any discipline who is willing to put together some kind of a research project with a faculty supervisor in their home department. The faculty supervisor would help them put together a reading list or a list of topics to explore. And then the graduate student would be allowed to travel with us, with the undergraduates and the faculty, down to Cuba, but their purpose would be a little bit different. They would be paired up with a research assistant at the Havana University who would help them find the resources and put together their research project. The graduate portion would be about 14 days, so substantially shorter than the undergraduate portion. Then after they return home to the United States in early June, the graduate students would get together with their faculty supervisors, put together their notes, write a final paper, and then receive a grade assigned by that faculty supervisor.
Is this the only opportunity that you know of in the state of Tennessee among higher education institutions for a chance to go to Cuba?
I think it is. I asked Rodrigo Gonzalez when he was here about that. There aren't very many. I think there's maybe four or five that he's aware of as someone who's very plugged in to the options that exist for universities now.
You mean among American universities?
Yes, yeah.
Across the country?
Yeah, yeah. So it's really a very rare opportunity to visit Cuba legally. It's always possible. It's always been possible to travel to Cuba illegally. You travel via a third country. You don't get your passport stamped. You don't tell anybody. You don't make a big deal about it. You try not to get arrested while you're traveling. Nobody will ever know. But, we've always traveled legally with our MTSU groups. And this really is an extraordinarily rare chance to go to see what Cuba's all about.
And if people want to know more, how do they get in contact with you?
They can contact me via telephone or email. My phone number is area code 615-898-2284, or just contact the Foreign Languages Department at MTSU, or send me an email at rmorris@mtsu.edu.
Dr. Rick Morris, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please be sure and join us at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.